Welcome to 3DBPM's Pulse Podcast. This is where we discuss the latest and most advanced, fascinating, powerful, and disruptive additive manufacturing technologies with the people that make them happen. I am your host, Davide Scher, CEO and co-founder of 3DBPM, the leading media, marketing, and market research firm for the ever-changing world of AM. And hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the 3DBPM Pulse Podcast. Our guest for today is James DeMuth, CEO of Surat Technologies, one of the most interesting and new companies to emerge targeting metal additive mass production. Surat has received a lot of media attention lately because it looks to introduce one of the most innovative and disruptive new technologies that we have seen, by leveraging, among other things, lessons learned from lasers used in nuclear fusion research. James holds a master's degree in mechanical engineering from Stanford University with a focus on energy systems and high temperature gas dynamics. He also has a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering from Santa Clara University. He has co-authored 83 patents and 13 academic publications in the fields of additive manufacturing and power generation. Prior to founding Surat, James was at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he worked on the Laser Inertial Fusion Energy Project. This is one of the most advanced machines ever created by humans, like CERN, like one of those really, really out of this world machines. And while working there, he co-invented and developed the core of Surat's breakthrough additive manufacturing technologies, which is called Aria Printing. Surat Technologies recently closed the 21 million Series B extension with investments from Xerox Ventures and SIP Global Partners. This brings the total funding for the company to 79 million. What makes Surat's vision for massively scaling metal AM even more credible is that James's background focuses precisely on how to efficiently handle and precisely the direct huge amounts of energy. Today, we have the opportunity to speak with James and understand more about the company's unique proposition for highly scalable AM via Aria printing technology and how this could lead to more sustainable mass manufacturing of metal parts. So, hi, James, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, David. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you. So, let's get started. Can you tell us a little bit more about the work you did at NIF?
Yeah, so the National Ignition Facility, right, has, you know, a system that contains 192 of the world's most energetic lasers, all focused to a target chamber that kind of looks like a little mini Death Star that is, you know, they're trying to do nuclear fusion experiments, particularly focused on weapon stockpiled stewardship. But, you know, they're also looking at, hey, can we make fusion energy a clean, non-CO2 emitting source that has no nuclear waste, right? And so that's sort of the mission of the National Ignition Facility at a high level. I was actually working on a subset of that, which was, how do you take that research facility that fires lasers once a day and turn it into a power plant, fire it 10 times a second, right? And, you know, my focus initially was sort of on the balance of plants, the, you know, heat exchanging systems, how do you get all that energy to electrons of the grid? And I kind of steadily made my way all the way, you know, back up to really the core of the fusion reaction, which was saying, you know, when that ignition goes off, there's just, it atomizes everything around it. And there's like a 6 meter radius sphere of just gas and previous targets. And so there's a lot of space, but everything just essentially becomes atomized because it's so incredibly hot. And then what happens after that, right? Things start to recoalesce. You start to form different chemical compounds and stuff. And we want to make sure that the right chemistry happens so things would flow nicely. Then it was also following the heat flow to the, you know, all the way out to the chamber walls where it would get absorbed by the coolant, and then ultimately off to generate electrons that go to the grid, right? So Everything in between. So it was really a full picture that we got to eventually, and it was a self-consistent solution for how you do this. Now, the National Ignition Facility is still working on getting to that, you know, net positive, but they're getting very, very close, sure, which is very exciting. you know, but it's the key part there, and the sort of the innovation that led to the additive manufacturing work was when we got to the part where, okay, how do you efficiently build a chamber to surround the fusion reaction? We needed, you know, we had a mandate to use today's materials, and they need to be, you know, non-activatable materials. So that meant you were very limited in what elements you could use. And we had to, we ended up having to be very creative mm-hmm. with the structures. And when you need to be creative with the structures, and you mm-hmm. also are limited on your material set, and you have to survive, you know, we said firing laser shots 10 times a second. Every laser shot produced a multi-hundred degree centigrade temperature swing on the first surface of the wall. So this is incredible fatigue. You need really robust, high temperature materials to handle this. So a lot of constraints. We end up with a material that couldn't traditionally be welded, but it turns out it could be laser 3D printed.
Right.
And well, okay, great. Well, that opens up all the doors on being able to be creative with the geometry. The problem was it was going to take 200 years for a single printer to fabricate one of our fusion chambers. So but, something
for the size, for the,
because for the size, it was the there's really... just so much mass, right? Okay. You know, a 6 meter radius chamber with, you know, walls that are anywhere between a millimeter and 5 millimeters thick.
Sure.
You know, and there's multiple of those. It just adds up really quick. So just pure mass at high resolution
right.
was an issue. And that really is what led us to this area of area printing to solve the problem.
Fantastic. I mean, I had done some articles and some research on the facility and how you need to concentrate this huge, you know, laser power into this tiny, tiny point to generate fusion. But that's really not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about the technology and how, you know, how we're gonna do, you know, high speed, as you said, high speed, high resolution, large parts, or many parts. So I'm, you know, as you can tell, I am not an engineer, but I'm very fascinated by advanced physics and technology in general. But in order to understand AM technologies, I try to compare them to other technologies that maybe I am already familiar with. In that sense, can you help us understand how area printing works?
Absolutely. So you are you familiar, I'm assuming, with laser powder bed fusion as it exists today, right? We take a laser, yep. focus it to a spot, you make a weld pool, and you drag it around, right? So that's kind of the status quo for laser powder bed fusion of, you know, to using lasers to melt metal. And really it's been around, shoot, since, you know, in plastics since the late 80s, in metals, early 90s.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the early 2010s, we started seeing an explosion of moving from one laser to two to four to six sure. to eight, 12. And I'm sure we'll get to 16, 20, 24, 30 with time, but it's not easy. It took us a decade to go from one laser to 12.
Yeah.
It's going to take us a while to get to, let's say, 100,000 or a million beams operating in parallel.
Yeah.
And when you look at scaling laser powder bed fusion, right, you really have two options. You can add more lasers, which maintains resolution. So each laser can have the same or better resolution or focus spot size than the other. Or you can just crank up the power and do it all in a single beam. Either way, you've got to add more power to go faster, right? And if you do it in a single beam, you trade off resolution because of the intensities you need to print. You end up having to defocus the beam. So what we're doing is a bit different, right? We say we want to go faster, so we need more power. Great, do that. Then we illuminate a bigger area because we need to maintain sort of the right quality power density to get good quality welds. And so in theory, we should lose resolution, but what we do next is the tricky part. We
right.
use specialized technology to apply a high resolution pattern to the laser real time, such that we can essentially have 6 to 10 micron pixels on our powder bed, yet an overall beam size that's maybe 15 millimeters on the side.
Wow.
And in that way, we can print a lot of material really fast and maintain high resolution during the process. So the analogy I'd say is laser powder bed fusion has traditionally been, you can think of it like writing a letter with a pen.
Mm-hmm.
And what Seurat is doing is like the printing press. We've been able to take a serial process, you know, single pixel printing, right? Printing one pixel at a time and change it to a massively parallel, essentially printing process.
Okay. And from my, again, not engineer point of view, the first things that comes to mind is that this would require, you know, large amounts of energy. How, and more so than how you get the energy, which you can get, and I'm sure we can get to that from clean or, you know, sources, electricity, etc., is how do you handle that energy?
Yeah, so, you know, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, also known as Lasers, Lasers, Nothing But Lasers, a lot okay. of experience there in manipulating, shaping, blending, handling laser light. Every optic the laser light hits, there's some loss. Generally thought of as about 0.25% per surface, right? Is you did good if you can make it to that. Really good is like 0.1% per surface. But, you know, if you've got dozens of optics, it adds up. And so you got to make sure you're maintaining and, you know, you're carefully managing how heat flows in the system. Ultimately, you know, every watt of power that your machine uses goes out as heat at the end of the day. And that's true of any system, right? That's just how it works, right? So, you know, we're going to be using a lot of power as part of converting powdered material to metal, but we're actually a bit more efficient than traditional laser powder bed fusion in the process because we have more control over how we do it. Mm-hmm. Traditional laser powder bed fusion overdrives the process considerably just so they can move on to the next pixel faster. And this results in the massive amounts of spatter, often called fireworks, that you see during the process, which are bad, right? Those are partially agglomerated powder particles that fly off and land in areas of virgin powder, and they don't print the same. They're print defects waiting to happen. And, you know, that's a loss as part of it, right? And it's a symptom of overdriving. And the other symptom I'd say is soot. You know, you see a lot of soot in today's laser powder bed fusion. You can watch the process and you can see the soot. We've been able to dial in higher print rates and you can't see the soot. Now, don't get me wrong, it's there. Anytime you're melting metal, there's soot, but it's at such small amounts, it's not visible. So proportionally, we're able to better control the process, which means we can be more efficient.
And I guess to follow up on that, you mentioned that you are able to do this through, or the key of the ARIA printing is a patterning device that you developed. Can you explain more about how that works, or what you can share? Because I'm sure there are things that are secret. And how, you know, how it came to be, how it was developed.
Yes, this device was originally developed for Lawrence Livermore to pattern the really high power fusion lasers for fusion research. And initially, the intent was as a programmatic beam blocker. So the team at Livermore wanted to block light from, you know, the laser in some small portion, maybe 0.001% of the beam they'd block, but it could be anywhere and it's arbitrary. So they needed something that was programmable. The reason for this was that, you know, the optics at the National Ignition Facility are huge. They're like 2 feet on a side or more. Wow. And any small defect that might be in those optics, if the laser light keeps hitting it, it'll grow and grow and grow over time. And eventually it'll cause fracture and failure of the optic. And those optics are really expensive and it's really time consuming to replace them. So you don't want that. So if you could only block the laser light from hitting that one tiny little spot, you could prevent that optic from failing. That would be wonderful. And this was a way to implement that solution. So that meant that this device was originally built with incredibly stringent requirements to handle these really high quality lasers for fusion. And so the insight we had was, wow, you're arbitrarily patterning laser light. You could use that for other things. You could use it for material fusion, so to speak. And so, you know, you could, if you applied a pattern to this, you could essentially do the process in parallel. And that was the insight, is that, wow, you could do that. Now, lasers that you use for, you know, welding metal are very different than lasers used for fusion. You want different parameters in there. So we're also looking at different average power loads, different peak power loads. So we've had to do a fair amount to take what originally was the Livermore device and turn it into something that's useful for us. It's more stringent in certain ways. It's less stringent in others. That's just sort of different application, right? But I'd say we now have the highest power patterning device that is in existence for lasers like this. So that's very exciting. And that's what's needed, we see, to implement this kind of parallelization of the technology.
And honestly, even as I'm not an engineer, I can understand the value of that. So let's get down to the part that we are more focused on, which is the business side of things. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you see your business model at, you know, now, and how it's going to evolve at Surat. And if you can help us understand, you know, the unique value proposition that as we've seen, can, you know, as we've seen in document you've shared in the past, can dramatically lower the price per part.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think there's two major factors for scaling that, you know, enable both current and future business models. And that's, you know, lasers have a fantastic scaling curve, but the problem is the industry can't really use it today, because if you just really, it's, you got to crank up the power in a single laser to get the benefits. If you just buy more of the same, not so much. So adding more lasers doesn't really help you with the economies of scale. It does somewhat, but it's minimal. The real big benefits are scaling up in a single beam. And if you do that with today's technology, you lose resolution. And then you have to machine the part extensively afterwards. So you don't quite get the same benefits. We see really, you know, the way we can leverage these incredible economies of scale is by patterning the lasers, maintaining resolution, and arbitrarily scaling our laser power. That gets really exciting. And we're looking at, you know, factors of 100 even or more from where we are today in terms of production rate. And that allows us to significantly drive down the cost curve that we see here for printed parts. Now, we start with doing what we call an applications lab with our customers. We call this the Area Printing Production Program, or AP program. And really, this is, we're working with large OEMs to qualify their parts for series production. And we start with first qualifying their material, verifying that, you know, this process is a new process, verifying we can hit all the required metrics, and then, you know, demonstrating that we can print their parts to their quality standards, hit the price targets they want to hit the quality, and hit the production rates that are needed. And ultimately, then we ramp to production. So those are the three phases that program goes through. And then we go into producing parts for that customer. Now, parts production versus machine sales, right? We can talk about that real quick. Machine sales is lumpy. And where we're going, our machines are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more expensive. So it's lumpy and even more spaced out. And the customer set that can buy them is fewer and far between, because as the machines get bigger, less customers are going to be able to afford them. So that, even though they get more expensive, our price per part that we can print parts at gets lower. So the barrier entry for part production drops. So also, once you've qualified a part for the customer and qualified, you've been qualified as a vendor, you know, if you were to sell them a machine, they now have to qualify themselves as a vendor, which adds in a lead time lag. So it's quicker to avoid that and just go straight to part production. So there's a lot of benefits. Also, part production looks like recurring revenue, right? Long-term agreements for producing parts, that's awesome. So it gives you more stability, more insight into where things are going. We think there's a lot of benefits. So we're starting with part production in our app program. We end in the end state with part production as we mature and get to really full size state, because that's where we see the best opportunity is.
And that's really, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing that you also emphasized a lot when we've spoken which we've mentioned before, is that one of your stated goals is to help decarbonize manufacturing. How do you see your technology doing that?
Yeah, so I think, as you pointed out earlier, my background's in heavily in both energy and manufacturing. And this. Right. So, you know, that's something I think about a lot. And we happen to be in a position where we're talking about, you know, our vision for the long-term stage of the company is to be deploying, let's say, print centers or print depots around the world. Our Gen 1 machine print depot would be around, let's say, 500 metric tons a year production, right? This is a 5 megawatt power, you know, power consumption. You can have a small power plant with that. That's where we start. It gets bigger. You know, the 2030 print depot is like a third of a gigawatt, right? You're definitely siting a power plant with that location. Right. Because we are talking about this level of power consumption, we're talking about having a lot more control and insight into how we choose the power source that we're getting. And our focus is to make this a, you know, a non-CO2 emitting source. And so this is the best way we can directly impact decarbonization of manufacturing, especially as we begin to outcompete on price point alone with traditional manufacturing techniques that produce greenhouse gases today, like, let's say, casting, right? Casting uses, you know, natural gas, uses coke. Those produce greenhouse gases. And for steel, the estimate is about half a ton of CO2 per ton of metal. Aluminum, it's like 2.5 tons of CO2 per ton of metal just in the casting process alone. Sure. So big opportunity that's direct right there. Indirect is obviously, you know, as you make parts lighter weight, they use less energy to move around. Everything benefits, anything that moves benefits from being lighter weight. Right. And I think there's often a, you know, if you look at a car, right, if you lightweight the frame and all the components in it, you can lightweight the engine. Absolutely. Because now you don't need as much power to drive it. And it's just, it's a circular loop that allows you to really drive things down that, you know, you get nonlinear math where 1 + 1 = 4. And that's where things get really exciting.
Yeah. Plus, I'm not sure if your vision includes this, but in theory, you know, with distributing manufacturing more, there is maybe less transportation. And then again, of course, if you do transportation via non-polluting methods, it's good. But if it's if you require less transportation, that's already an advantage there. I mean, if the energy is it goes to just a static place that doesn't have to move.
Absolutely. You know, well, really the goal here of having these print depots deployed around the world, right, is they're deployed near large OEM sites. So you can have parts made where they're needed, when they're needed, minimizing the transportation of goods shuffling around. So, and you could even imagine, you know, we look at this, you know, our 2030 print facility, it uses 92,000 metric tons a year of metal. That's printed material. Forget about all the extra powder you need to support the process, right? And so we're likely going to have powder production on site. And you can even envision a future where you're mining the material, producing the powder and producing it to part all in a very nearby area. Yeah. So you can have very minimized amount of mass being moved around, because literally those numbers, 92,000 metric tons is a unit of mass. So we're talking about a massive amount of material being being shuffled about if you don't do things right.
That's a big change. And anyways, shipping material is probably a lot easier than shipping parts from my understanding. And so which segments in particular are you targeting, I guess, in the beginning and then in more long term?
Yeah. So initially starting off, we're looking for segments that are relatively short qualification timelines and also segments that are hungry. They haven't been served yet by the, you know, essentially additive manufacturing as it exists today. And we're finding that those are more in the, you know, automotive, consumer electronics, and energy versus aerospace and medical as an example. Not to say there aren't applications, but in general, those two those industries have higher qualification timelines versus others. So, you know, there's a crossover, of course. Different parts have different qualification timelines in all industries, but those generally are kind of what we start with as sort of the first beachhead and then expand from there.
Absolutely. Okay, so can you help us understand how big the company is now and more in detail what your plans are for future growth?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're 57 people today. We've hired about, we've almost doubled in size in the last 6 months. And we're probably going to double again here in the next year, and potentially doubling again the year after that. So,
which more or less the additive.
Yeah, right. More or less the additive trajectory. You know, I think as we're getting to that point where, you know, we have our first customers starting, and we're getting a lot of really good interest and we're making a lot of great progress. And so that means we're trying to expand what we have to handle more customers. So there's definitely a ramp up coming in a variety of ways, not just in engineering, but in, you know, facilitating that customer engagement and those operations there. So very exciting times. And I think that's, you know, we're looking to see that continuing to expand as we grow. Our first print depot, probably, I mean, that's going to come hand in hand with once we qualify our first series production parts. And, you know, the volumes of parts we're talking about, you know, range from needing, let's say, one whole print depot per part to maybe, you know, a quarter of a print depot per part. And sometimes more than that, more than a print depot. So it really just depends on the customer. But in general, you know, that gives you a sense for the magnitude. And each print depot is like 500 metric tons a year, right? So it's we're looking at a good amount of of material. And that means we're not looking to do prototypes and one-offs. We're looking to do higher volumes. And again, it's a volume of material. So it could be a smaller number of big parts or a larger number of small parts. You know, the way we look at it, it's very much material mass driven for this, just which affects so many aspects of the process.
And so your business approach is to establish partnerships with these initial clients to fine tune the technology for their requirements, basically.
Yes, and fine tune more so the process. The technology itself has got a lot of capabilities in it. Sort of already, we see the most modulation is going to be within the bounds of what we have. But you know, we're very capable. You know, part of our journey was, you know, we found out, hey, off-the-shelf lasers couldn't do what we need them to do. They were, you know, we're a pulsed system. We're not continuous. And so, you know, the off-the-shelf, what's called a Q-switched laser, just was delivering a pulse that was not the right temporal shape for what we needed. And we needed something different. And we knew what we needed. And we knew how to make a laser to make that happen. So we did it. And ultimately, I think what it comes down to is the level of control. And what we've implemented here for this system is the ability to control. Let's say, you know, we print an area at a time. So whoomp, big slug of laser energy comes and welds an area in an instant. And that area has got, you know, millions of pixels within it. And we can control the intensity of each pixel during that pulse and the heating rates and the cooling rates of the material in each pixel during that pulse. And that's huge for controlling material properties, controlling, you know, the spatter, you know, so slow your roll on your heating rate, and that can help you eliminate the spatter. Control how you allow the material to cool, and that means you can control crystal structure, grain orientation, surface finish, you know, those metallurgical properties in there that are hugely dependent upon cooling rates, you can start to affect. And, you know, do you want to dial in residual stress in some areas and not in others? You can start to map that out and make that happen while you're printing your part. And so this new level of control, you know, this is a lot of knobs, which is daunting on one end, but it's exciting on the other, right? So we're just barely starting to turn the knobs, but we actually have the knobs to turn, which is the exciting part. And we can turn them without slowing the process down, which is huge for cost and production rate.
Absolutely. And I think what's really fascinating is that it kind of, you know, this is the only really new production technology beside, you know, the binder jetting approaches that has been really presented in terms of achieving high resolution parts. And the binder jetting approaches are still somewhat far away. And it seems like this technology can actually, you know, offer the benefits in terms of speed of you know, the theoretically coming binder jetting technologies, while at the same time offer the benefits in terms of material, you know, resolution, material handling, and the material also variety of powder bed fusion technology. So even from a journalistic point of view, I think this is really, really exciting, what the potential is. But so can you, how do you, like, what are you looking for now? Are you looking for companies to come to you with their requirements, or just really focusing on developing, you know, fine tuning the process?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've got a very big funnel, and it's a lot of companies to chew on here to take next steps with. I'd say that the biggest thing that we're looking for right now in terms of companies is applications that are, you know, have relatively low qualification timelines, but you still need to have, you know, quality metal, right? You know, we're working at materials that at least meet ASTM standards, if not more. And, you know, we're talking about a full melt process. So, you know, you don't have shrinkage, right? As you would in, say, a binder jetting solution. And you can have arbitrarily thick members, right? You know, binder jetting is limited to what, like about an inch or so before you get to a point where you just can't get the binder out. And so there's no binder. There's none of that issue. So it's full melt, full density. You know, you can be anything from, you know, a couple hundred microns, or less than a couple hundred microns. I think we're looking at about 100 microns feature sizes all the way up to, you know, as big as you want to go. You know, obviously, as you get bigger, you need to start worrying about thermal profiles and all that fun stuff. But guess what? We have the control knobs to be able to address that. So really, those are kind of the speed aspect is sort of the initial customer set that we'd be looking at. There's a lot of applications out there that take a long time to qualify, and we're going to get to those. But those maybe aren't the first ones that we should be working on. That's the commercial aspect. I'd say, you know, we're also looking for, you know, bright, excited, motivated, talented people to come join our team. And, you know, I think today's hiring market is a little crazy, but it's something that we're, you know, we think we have an ability to cut through some of the noise there. And, you know, we're talking about changing the future of manufacturing, right? Make additive be cost competitive with conventional manufacturing without design for additive. And when you get to that point, all of a sudden, all the design for additive issues are and benefits are secondary. And then that can just be icing on the cake when you're ready.
Right.
And so that lowers the barrier to entry. You can now, you know, eat your pasta without having to learn Italian or whatever the phrase is these days. Of course, we all want to learn Italian, but it's a, you know, how do you lower the barrier to entry? Everyone should be able to enjoy some good pasta.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's fantastic. But one thing I didn't ask you much about is what about the machine? Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, the system, like how, you know, the size of it, or describe a little bit more about, you know, how your machine, what the machine looks like.
Yeah. So it's kind of the size of a very much a traditional laser powder bed fusion machine, maybe a little bit smaller and with 10 times the production rate. So your production per square foot is huge. And that's, I think, where, you know, we've got a lot of feedback, especially from folks in Europe that, you know, and around the world that, you know, floor space is an issue. And so we've taken that to heart, and we've designed a system that is compact and can have really high uptimes. We are also finishing prints on the order of, you know, 6, 8, 10 hours. And traditionally, changing out a print bed can take, you know, a big fraction of a day, if not, you know, a whole day to do. And so if you're taking, let's say, 4 hours to do a print, and it takes you a day to change out a print bed, that's not a good cycle time. So we've done a lot to really optimize such that your transition time between prints is, you know, let's say 15 minutes or less. And that our goal is the lasers should always be firing. They should always be delivering laser energy to the bed. You should always be utilizing that capital equipment cost that, you know, we put in. And, you know, us being an operator of our own machines, right, we are self-motivated to make that happen, right? Because that's our productivity, right? That's how we get those parts at those low costs to our customers.
Fantastic. And last thing is, where do you see yourself and the company 10 years from now? I mean, is it going to be a fully commercialized and, you know, established technology? And in general, what do you expect for the future of additive manufacturing?
Yeah, we're starting off with our first generation of machine, and we've got a long roadmap of future generations, you know, in our back pocket that we're working on in the background, and when they're ready, they'll be released. And this allows us just to continually march down this cost per kilo curve for printed material. And, you know, first we're competing with machining, and then we're competing with casting, and then we're eventually competing with forging applications. And so, you know, it allows us to sort of unlock that capability to really broadly compete with conventional manufacturing. And I guess we see additive is, we think of what we're doing not necessarily as additive, but as manufacturing. It just happens to have an additive history. And with that comes all the benefits of additive. And really, when we fast forward 10 years from now, you know, we're looking to have additive applications ubiquitous across all the products that you see, feel, and touch. And that means you can then leverage the benefits of additive for them to really move the goalpost, right? Do things you could never do before, improve quality, improve capability. And, you know, essentially, you know, we often talk about the next generation of materials can be metamaterials, right? You know, you might have a block of steel, but it's got a micro lattice in between it, right? That makes it, you know, a tenth the weight and, you know, very, very stiff. And wow, you just made steel behave like carbon fiber, but infinitely recyclable, right? So you can do that with engineered structures, and you start to make what were standard materials, because you have embedded structure in them, behave like some new material that didn't exist before. And that's when you also, that, you know, that's another wave of unlocking capability there. So democratizing manufacturing, making it available really for anyone, and allowing for this new capability at that low cost is how we see the way to do it.
And that's really a great vision, and it's definitely something to look forward to. Thank you so much for your time. It's all the time we have for today. It was really, really interesting, and I'm sure we will be, you know, following you and keeping an eye on your progress very closely, and we'll of course be reporting it. Thank you again. Thanks to everyone for joining us, and speak soon.
Terrific. Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.